Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week, our special guest is Josh Klinghoffer, who you may know from his time in various bands and projects, including The Bicycle Thief, Ataxia, Dot Hacker, and about a decade or so as a member of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. However, Josh has a solo project, Plural One, that I am absolutely mesmerized by. Having gotten the first album, To Be One With You, some time ago from a publicist named Chris Esty, who couldn't stop raving about it. Now, Chris always has great taste, and when those people speak, it's important to take their advice seriously. Anyway, I got a copy of the album, and I ended up diving headfirst into the works of Josh Klinghoffer. And it's an amazing journey amongst his other works. I must have played the album To Be One With You a dozen times in the first month I had it. It's an amazingly emotional and well-produced album. And now Josh / Plural One has released a second album, I Don't Feel Well, which immediately went on heavy rotation in my house and I believe is another step in the growth of Josh and the Plural One project. I'd suggest dialing up the album on a streaming service, checking it out for yourself, and you can explore the vinyl versions at orgmusic.com or pluralone.merchnow.com. I'll put the links in this episode page. There's a limited edition gold vinyl release, which I'd suggest grabbing before it's gone, plus some other 7-inch singles and his first album as well. Now, Josh is quite an open book. Today in the interview, he and I discuss a lot of areas of his life and career, his history with vinyl, Josh's process for songwriting, how this new album came to be, what it's like being an artist in this day and age, the collectability of records, his previous projects, and heaps more. Again, 2020 has not been a good year for most people, but there's been a handful of albums which I've been absolutely blown away by, and this is one of them. Check it out for yourself. Josh Klinghoffer, I Don't Feel Well, available now on all streaming services. Try before you buy, but then get in quick at pluralone.merchnow.com. And this week's episode is brought to you in part by our homies at audiophileusa.com. With over 42,000 titles in stock, audiophileusa.com will package your order beautifully and ship it directly to your front door. AudiophileUSA.com only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records, so don't worry about the condition. They'll be absolutely gorgeous on your ears and eyes. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And a big shout out to the team at GrooveWasher.com for making the best record cleaner on earth. The GrooveWasher record cleaning kits help your records sound their very best and helps your equipment last longer. Go to GrooveWasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout for an extra 10% off whatever you get at GrooveWasher.com. Protect your audio investment and hear the most music with the GrooveWasher. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. That's GrooveWasher.com. Proud to be made in the USA. And finally, if you enjoy this interview, check out our other Vinyl Guide episodes for more music and vinyl nerdery, including episode 210 with Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke, episode 206 with Sub Pop Records founder Bruce Pavitt, episode 204 with Caspian's Philip Jameson, and former United States Congressman and presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke talking punk rock records on episode 238 of The Vinyl Guide. All episodes and interviews available anytime on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Sonnet, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with that, let's get into today's conversation with Josh Klinghoffer of Plural One. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Josh? How's Sunday afternoon in California?
I think it's pretty good. I haven't seen much of it. I was going to do a rare thing this morning and go out and read in the backyard, but I got a phone call, so that didn't happen. So I guess it was lovely enough for me to try to do that.
Are you an early riser, or are you one of these guys that kind of wakes up around noon and stays up late?
No, I've been both in my life, but right now I'm sort of splitting that difference, and I get up at around 9.
Oh, that's respectable.
Yeah. Well, and it's usually because I'm sitting in bed at night reading or watching something later than I should be, so I sleep in a little bit later. I do love getting up in the morning, and you know, it's a special time.
So when you go into bed, do you watch things to go to sleep, or do you watch things to be entertained and read to go to sleep?
I watch things to go to sleep, and I read. I don't read to go to sleep because I usually want to put something on to watch to go to sleep. So I read when I still can focus. I usually read in the morning, but to fall asleep, I watch things I've seen 1,000 times. So I usually watch something, start falling asleep during it, and then if I have the energy to, I somehow with eyes half closed, I find something that I've seen a million times.
Whenever I travel and I have a difficult time sleeping in a hotel room, I have this documentary series on my laptop. It's Ken Burns and the History of Jazz.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
And I love jazz and I love Ken Burns, but there's, for some reason, this documentary, I'll start watching it and within about 6 minutes, I'm getting ready to go to sleep.
Well, Ken Burns is really soothing. It's like someone stroking your hair. And I got, are you a baseball fan at all? Because that's a good one, too.
Oh, yeah. I did. I have seen that as well. That one kind of keeps me quite awake because there's a lot of footage to see. Right. But with the jazz one, you know, there's not a lot of footage. And they'll be like, well, you know, Stinky J. Robinson played the piano in this pub in Lower East Side. And pretty soon I'm just lulled to sleep.
The last several times I went and stayed in New York, I would do exactly that with Ken's brother Rick's New York documentary series.
Oh,
another good one if you haven't seen New York one. Rick Burns.
Rick Burns. Oh, okay. He's the Ken Burns knockoff.
He's his brother. R.I.C. Yeah. For the longest time, I was thinking, oh yeah, you know Ken Burns, New York, and I realized that I had been saying that incorrectly. It's actually Rick Burns.
Well, look, Josh, I got to tell you, I've been enjoying this new album, I Don't Feel Well, and it is, I don't get emotional or I don't get choked up over many albums, but I find myself getting emotional on this one, and I'm not sure why. It's not uncommon. I kind of got some of that with the first album, but man, you certainly do know how to put powerful music into the universe.
Wow. That's the nicest thing anyone said to me, and I don't remember how long. Thank you so much.
Oh.
And thank you. Okay. Thank you for listening to it. I mean, the fact that it makes you feel something is, it takes a lot for me to admit to myself that, that can actually happen. I still just can't believe that people listen to anything I do, let alone, you know, react to it like that. So thank you.
Well, thank you for making the music. And before we get into the interview, let me ask you this. I'm not sure you hear this question very often, but are you related at all with Leon Klinghoffer?
Yeah. That is undetermined. And I think for years I used to, my answer was, yes, I think I am, but very, very distant, mm-hmm. You know, like sort of 4 or 5 generations removed. My grandfather, who was named Leonard Klinghoffer, who was probably about 10 or 15 years younger than Leon, they may have met. Like, the thing is that my grandfather was always saying that, yeah, we were. My grandfather, the Klinghoffer side, he was saying that there was a familial connection. And then since he died, my grandmother, his widow, said, she's kind of made me feel like maybe he was just saying that. So, and now I'm doubting it. But I think it's possible. And if it is, it's because there was sort of a, it was about 4 or 5 generations ago.
Right, right.
You know, like there was a couple of, you know, they, so I think, you know, perhaps the it was in the Eastern Europe when those two factions of the family split. So I don't even know. One thing I do know is that there have been Klinghoffers or people that have done a lot of research about the family histories, and my family and his are on that. So I think there is a connection, but it's just, it's pretty distant.
That name was embedded in my head as a youngster because I always tried to talk my father into taking my mother on a vacation, and he always would come back, I'm going to end up like Klinghoffer, and he would never go.
Yeah. And then John Adams wrote the minimalist harmonium opera. Do you know that?
No, I don't.
Yeah. The Death of Klinghoffer. I remember seeing a CD of it that someone must have given my parents, you know, in our house. And then years later, I became a fan of John Adams's music. But at the time, he wrote an opera, like a minimalist opera about that happening.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, check it out. I don't really know that piece very well. There's other things by him that I like, but it's out there.
Was there a lot of music around your house? Like what were some of the pivotal records of your youth?
Well, I always say that my dad and his brother, my uncle, around 5 years old, made me Beatles and Beach Boys tapes. My uncle made me a couple of Beach Boys mixes and my dad made me a couple of Beatles mixes. So those are the two that I feel like started me off. My dad has a huge record collection. I wouldn't say that there was a ton of music being listened to all the time around the house, but I think when he was younger, he was enormously passionate about it. But I think just through looking at him, you know, consider himself a music fan and a record collector, I sort of got that bug. Because we had all sorts of different records, and it's funny because I don't know who bought them, but I remember listening to my parents had Culture Club. I think of that as a big one for me when I was really young, that like Culture Club. And then my dad also liked country stuff, newer country stuff, like Towns Van Sant or Steve Earle and those kind of people. Yeah, so there was always music around the house.
Okay. It seems quite eclectic and quite open to different genres and styles.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to think of that because, you know, nowadays it goes by in the blink of an eye. But I very vividly remember getting really into the Beatles and the Beach Boys at age 5. I know it for sure. It was around age 5 because my whole family, apart from my parents, lived back in New York and New Jersey. So we would go back east and I would listen to these tapes on a Walkman. And then by eight years old, nine, like I was already into my own, you know, whatever music I liked. So those 3 years now disappear like that. But back then it seemed like a lifetime. Mm. But by eight, I was already really into, you know, Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue and then, you know, some English bands, like whatever was on MTV kind of things I would see.
Wow. Now, what did your parents, what was their reaction when you brought home a Motley Crue album? Were they supportive? Were they kind of raising their eyebrow? What were they doing?
I don't know. It's as interesting. I can't remember so much what their thought of their opinions of Motley Crue were. I know my mother thought Tommy Lee was cute, but I remember listening to Guns N' Roses with my parents and my dad got me Appetite on cassette from, I think that was my first copy of it. So, you know, I feel like they weren't that old at the time. They were only, you know, in their early 30s. Mm-hmm. And it seemed back then like there was this generational divide, but, you know, basically my dad's always been a huge Bruce Springsteen person. And now, you know, some of the bands I grew up listening to are peers of Bruce Springsteen, and it's all sort of melded together.
My father used to listen to polkas, and I was bringing home Public Enemy, so there was a huge divide there.
Okay, yeah. See, it wasn't as extreme in our house.
So your dad had a big record collection, yeah? I mean, do you recall much about it? Does he still have it? Is he still around?
He does still have it, but he sort of, you know, he kind of moved away from, for practical reasons, mostly caring about the stacks of vinyl records. So he's got most of them in his closet. Whichever ones he doesn't have anymore are in my collection. And he, you know, he still listens to lots of music, but he's not so much of a record collector anymore. I mean, he definitely listens to music all the time, but it's more, you know, digital or CDs in the car and stuff like that.
Was he kind of precious about it? Like, oh, be careful. These are, you know, these records are expensive. So he was,
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had to be careful with them. And I learned from an early age to treat them with the utmost respect. I had a Yorks boombox. I mean, after my Fisher-Price turntable, which I still have, I had a Yorks stereo turntable, double cassette. And I remember, I got that for Christmas. And I remember listening to his copies of Genesis, Invisible Touch. One of the first records I bought with my own money was a reissue of the Beatles' Help. Listen to that. Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet. That was an early one of mine that I owned.
Yeah. Definitely a kid of the 80s.
Yes. How old are you?
I'm 50. So I was born 69.
Okay.
You were 79, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Were records still a big thing growing up? Or you were cassettes and probably onto CDs?
Like I said, I remember buying those first couple, like that Beatles record. I remember buying at Tower. in Northridge, California. But I think CDs were, my first format was cassettes. I mean, I bought a couple vinyl records, but my dad had so many that I listened to his. So cassettes were my thing. And then not too long after that, we all made the big jump to CDs. Mm-hmm. So my collection was mostly CDs. And then but I still always loved vinyl. So I would buy, I was just talking about this the other day with somebody. It was weird what I selectively would save money for and decide that needs to be owned on vinyl. Because I remember riding my bike the week, I think back in those days, sometimes bands would put vinyl out the week before. So I also had an arbitrary sort of selection of what I would leave sealed. So I still have a sealed copy of In Utero that I remembered riding my bicycle to get. And for some reason, something told me to save that and leave it sealed. So I have that. And I remember Pearl Jam's Verses. I rode my bike and got a week before that came out on vinyl. Mm. So this is, you know, age 13.
Wow. Yeah, the angels have been sharing their secrets with you. So the records you bought, you would bring home, and you never felt any judgment from your parents. In fact, they were quite supportive, it sounds like. They'd even listen to it with you, yeah?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I mean, they definitely, they were not against me listening to music at all, no. And I started playing the drums at age 9, and my memory of it is that I was wandering around the music store in Canoga Park, California, trying to decide whether I wanted to be a drummer or a guitar player. And my mother must have assumed that I had selected drums. So she signed me up for drum lessons. And I remember having this moment where I thought, oh, is that, I didn't know yet. Okay, sure. So they signed me up for drums, which turned out to be, you know, kind of a bummer for them for the next several years, every weekend, or, you know, most of the time, that's what they had to hear from the other room.
At least they didn't select bagpipes. That would have been worse.
Right. I guess you could say they were always supportive of me playing and mm-hmm. listening to music. I mean, I think they could probably, I've never talked to them about this, but they could see that it was very important to me and that I should talk about this with them tonight when I go see them. But, you know, I feel like it was clear early on that I was someone who was basing their identity off of what they listened to and these people that made the music that I listened to. You know, I'm 8 years old, like putting on the Motley Crue, you know, makeup, like the it's either the Motley Crue makeup from the Shout at the Devil videos or the athlete, you know, sun, the sun.
Oh yeah. The black stripes, yeah, the war paint.
Yeah.
Did you always think you were going to be in music? Did you always think like, okay, this is my job, this is what I'm going to do?
I don't think when I was really young, I didn't have that idea that it was anything serious or, you know, I just loved playing. And I, mm-hmm. the way I remember it is that just like with the drums where I was sort of like, oh, okay, I guess I'm playing drums. And then I devoted my time and my energy to that for several years. When I started playing guitar, it was because I was kind of sick of the drums or sick of having to take drums around. And, you know, anytime you were playing with people, you had to get a ride. I didn't drive yet. So I was kind of sick of that. So when I left high school at age 15, I sort of taught myself guitar because I was really enjoying, you know, the beginnings of guitar playing and being able to express myself, I guess, tonally. I don't think I was thinking along these lines back then, but I sort of started teaching myself guitar. And then around 17, when I met Bob Forrest, I was suddenly a guitar player. Like it was never something that I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm setting my sights on this. And then, once we met, I was 17, and then it just kind of happened from there. And in one way or another, you can kind of, mm-hmm. you can say I've just sort of been riding the same wave that I jumped on at 17 from meeting Bob Forrest through my best friend's sister.
It sounds like you didn't even have time to figure out what a plan B for your life was. It was just music from the beginning and just morphed into something that began almost immediately as you entered adulthood.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to bemoan the fact that I was from Los Angeles because I felt like people come here to play and people come here to put something together. I grew up sort of idolizing what I saw coming from Seattle or a scene like, you know, New York mm-hmm. or other places, Manchester and, you know, the late 70s or something. I always envision these places where groups of people came together. I never really knew anyone growing up. I had my, you know, my best friend at the time was a bass player. We played together, but you know, I never really had bands growing up until I met Bob Forrest. And that wasn't even a band at first. It was kind of just he and I, and he was in his mid-30s and I was 17. So it was always kind of a funny pair. But yeah, no, you're right. It kind of just happened. And then from there, I met these people, and then this happened, and then this happened, and this happened. It really seems like one long, continuous journey.
It would seem like your parents, I mean, they would have been familiar with the life of a musician and heard the stories and things like that. Were they concerned at all that you were entering that world?
No, not that I know of. I don't think, I don't, you know, they were never, you know, my dad works in film and TV, and, you know, he knows musicians or people that play on the side, and he's definitely familiar. They're both familiar with the culture, but I don't think they, you know, they were far more worried about the fact that I just said, you know, screw it and stop going to high school. I think I was just kind of off and touring with people by the time, you know, I was already somewhat of an adult, I guess, by the time, you know, any of that happened. So
right.
The big fight came at 15 when I said, see you later to Granada Hills High School.
So your dad was in the industry. He was a sound guy. Yeah. Did you guys have sound equipment around the house?
Yeah, we did. We had a Nagra machine that I, you know, I didn't know how to use, and I, you know, he would take on jobs, but it, you know, it sat there and it looked beautiful. Mm-hmm. And he would, you know, there'd be a couple microphones around the house once or twice in the garage, but not a ton of gear. I think that stuff mainly stayed on set.
Would you get your hands on it? Would you ever be able to use some of that equipment and just kind of learn a little bit about it?
I wouldn't say necessarily the stuff that he had, but from an early age, I borrowed a Tascam cassette 8-track from a friend from school. And borrow is a funny word because I still have it. Yeah, 25 years later.
Has he asked for it back?
Oh, no. I mean, he never did. But oddly, that kid disappeared. We still never know what happened to that guy. So I couldn't give it back even if I wanted to. But I just sort of started becoming sort of whatever bedroom obsessed with recording at that time, sort of 14, 15 years old. I, you know, once I started being able to make some sort of noise on guitar, bass came easily as well. And I already played the drums. So at that time, I was, at least as far as I knew, the most advanced multi-instrumentalist I knew of. So I think I probably got a little complacent and stayed there for, like, you know, far longer than I should have. And all of a sudden I was 20 in my mid 20s instead of, or mid 30s. And I, you know, I don't know how much better I got at any of those things, but for a while when I was at 14, 15, I was making what I thought were really impressive home recordings.
Yeah. Well, it sounded like you had the,
I never really progressed past that machine. I have about 9 of them now. And the way I do demos for the most part is by having that same Tascam 488, Mach 2 or whatever, MK2. Mm-hmm. I have several of them all over the place, and like different parts of my house or different parts of my workspace. And I just take the tapes around, and the mics are plugged into those machines. And, you know, if I need drums, I go to the one that's near the drums. If I need piano, I go to that one. So I've sort of cultivated this really funny version of the same thing I did when I was 15.
You're still doing it. Wow. Is that your writing process?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, the iPhone and, you know, voice memos on the phone is pretty essential to me now because my short-term memory is pretty horrendous. But I get an idea down, and when I want to actually flesh it out or make a recording for myself to write vocals to, or, you know, to practice vocals to or whatever it is, I use those 8-tracks. Yeah. And that's what I did fairly soon after the world shut down earlier this year, as I have an attic, and I brought an 8-track up there, and I brought a couple of keyboards up there and some microphones and a few guitars. And I basically did an album's worth of demos. And I just told myself I was going to try and record a song a day. Even if I didn't have a song finished lyrically and a full idea, I was going to do an instrumental of some kind, get a drum loop or get a sample of something and treat it with synthesizers. So I was going to do a recording every day. And, you know, I have to watch myself when I say this kind of stuff, but at least back then, the way the world was, of course, there's a horrible thing going on in the world. But, for me, I haven't had this much uninterrupted time, mm-hmm. you know, probably since the period we were just talking about when I was 17, where I was just sort of, I had nothing to do but work and be creative. And it was amazing. So that was the beginning of what became this album.
Yeah. When you're young, you have plenty of time, but not enough gear. And when you get old, you can give yourself all the gear. You can't get time. So
that's exactly right.
Now I've had some other folks on the show that songwriters, like Mike Doty and Steve Pultz, and they do this song a day sort of discipline, and they're part of a group. They almost kind of push each other to be able to do it, sending each other tracks, that sort of thing. Do you do any of that? Do you do any cross collaboration, or is it pretty much you doing that song a day in isolation?
Well, it's pretty much me doing it on my own for this project or for this record that I did. But I finally got off my ASS this last couple of months and taught myself GarageBand so that I could, you know, taught myself how to record digitally so I could share it with other people. So I have done a little bit of that in the last 6 months.
You can't send those 488 tapes around.
Right. I tried. Long story short, I had a really good friend of mine got in a terrible accident, and he was recovering for most of the beginning of this period. And I one night I just sat down and I wrote a little thing, and I did it on the 8-track, and I sent it around to the group of his close friends that were in close communication around this time. And he, you know, when we were getting updates about his condition, and I did it with on the 8-track, and I shared it with everyone. And I said, so if, you know, please everyone jump on this song, let's make it a thing for our group and for him and do it. And, but the fact that it was on that tape, and the speed was, you know, infinitesimally drifting, made it very difficult for the fella who had to organize it in the computer. But I washed my hands of it, and I did my thing, and I let it go. But once I saw how difficult that was to work with tape and other people, I taught myself how to record on the computer and be able to send it around.
Now, do you find yourself being inspired by events like that and just writing a song right away?
Inspiration can come from anything, I think. That instance in particular, I mean, I have a terrible habit for the last 20 years of writing songs, writing half the lyrics, and then just walking away and letting them stay in this sort of unfinished pool of potential. And, you know, I've always had an excuse like, oh, well, I'm going on tour with this person, or, you know, for 10 years I was playing in the Chili Peppers, and I could always kind of let my songs remain undone because I didn't know when or with whom I was going to get to record them or play them. And I've been working really hard to try and correct some of those bad habits. And, you know, sometimes songwriting or lyric writing takes a lot of thought, and sometimes you just can't do it, and you can't focus, and you do need a little bit of time. But I have found that, you know, sometimes a song start to finish in basically the amount of time it takes to play it will come out. I mean, maybe it's the way the world is right now. I have had more time to just let that happen. That one in particular was one of those examples. I mean, in fact, I remember that night I was telling myself, it's, you know, it's late, you should go, you know, it's time to go upstairs. And I sort of forced myself to stay there and get enough lyric down to where I could share it with his wife and kind of, you know, just share it with the group, you know, the next day, that, you know, this is something that we can all be a part of for him and for their family.
Now, do you feel that the songs that kind of come to you in a flood are inherently different than the ones you have to work quite hard on, or maybe you need to sit and let bake or ferment for a while?
I don't know. It's all different, because sometimes, I mean, it's all kind of a matter of your level of confidence and quieting the critic in your mind, you know, or at least for me it is. And I think there are songs musically that were written 20 years ago that I'm still sort of pondering. And I think, and then the lyric happens one day nowadays, and I feel like, well, I guess that couldn't have been written 20 years ago, because whatever I've experienced in the interim has made it happen now. And there's a song on this new record called Knowing You. And, you know, those chords and that melody have been around for over 10 years. And I just, you know, I knew what it was called, and I knew roughly that it was going to be about kind of this or that or whatever. And then, you know, just having the time and the focus, and now 12 more years of life experience, I was able to sit down and write, you know, far too much actually for that song. And then the process of editing and putting something into coherent order, you know, I still am struggling with, you know, singing legibly and having people understand what I'm saying. But, you know, for me, I feel like there are people that are born and come out of the gate with all the confidence in the world. For me, it's always been a struggle, and sort of, you know, feeling like I had a place to do this is something I've, you know, it's taken, you know, 20 years of playing with some of the greatest and most influential people to, you know, let me feel like I have a, you know, I'm allowed to do this.
Is that difficult for you to see? Because from an outsider perspective, here's a guy who's played with so many greats and he's been asked to participate in the sort of musical events and collaborations that are just, you know, most musicians and artists would die to have. But here you are still struggling with the confidence. Is it difficult for you?
Well, it's certainly difficult to struggle with that confidence. I mean, I don't know how often throughout my entire life I've been fully aware and conscious of what I was dealing with emotionally, or what the reasons for this, that, or the other thing being difficult were. But, you know, the confidence, I think, just being like, I sort of always bemoan not having a band, not growing up with that experience that I feel like, you know, a lot of people have. The Chili Peppers, they were playing together and making sounds and having fun since high school. I never really had that experience. And then I started playing with people and started touring with established other bands all through my 20s. And that was an amazing experience. And I wouldn't trade it for the world. But I always kind of felt sorry for myself that I never had what I viewed as a more preferable path. But then, you know, you realize someday that, you know, my path is, I mean, not only is it unique and amazing, and I love every minute of it, and I'm grateful for it, but I was able to experience a world or a life in music and kind of look at how I wanted to do it and how I wanted to approach making my own music. And it's almost, you know, it's almost for the better. I mean, I feel like I didn't have that band. I didn't have that group of people uniting for a purpose, which I feel like is kind of essential. I never wanted to be a solo guy. You know, me at 20 years old wouldn't have gone out and made a record under my own name. I probably would never do that. But I mean, make a record like I've made now and lead a project. I just probably wouldn't have had that confidence and that experience. So yeah, I mean, I would say it was very difficult along the way to always be faced with these impediments. But, you know, now that I've made it to a couple days ago, age 41, and I'm making music and I've lived a life that's allowed me to do that, and I still have as much dedication to it, and as you know, I still want to learn and still want to get better. I mean, I don't know if everyone can be as lucky as I am to still be able to be as interested in getting better and learning, you know. So So to answer your question in a long-winded way, I apologize, but it was very hard at times to look at, you know, myself and go, why is this hard, or why am I struggling with confidence? But I think all the while I was, you know, I was living a life and I was doing what needed to happen to, you know, gain the confidence. And perhaps it just took a little longer. I don't know if you're born with confidence. You know, I always used to think the opposite. I think I was born with a lack of confidence. So I've maybe come up to the medium level.
Yeah. There's no judgment in it at all. It's just, to me, it's very interesting. Just with various interviews we've had and just understanding that everyone, even if they've played in these tremendous situations and had this very unique global success, everyone seems to have some sort of confidence challenges, or was it imposter syndrome, to where, you know, it's just a matter of time before they find me out. And I think that speaks more to the human condition, perhaps a little bit even more pronounced as an artist than anything.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for me, you know, maybe I'm overthinking things to a degree, or have always been, or just predisposed to that. But, you know, a lot of people out there write songs, and a lot of people make music that they like, and a lot of people want you to hear music that they like, and a lot of people want to have a career in music. And especially as it gets easier and easier for people to do it at home. And, you know, I've just always struggled with why does anyone want to listen to my dumb ass? Like, I need to feel like I have a reason that I'm taking their time and attention and something to say, if nothing, you know, if for no other reason to show myself that I have a reason to be doing this, you know. And like I said earlier, like it still takes a lot for me to sometimes sing clearly and write in a way that's easy to understand upon first listen. But, you know, everyone has only so much time and bandwidth, especially these days. So, you know, kind of just feeling like, you know, once I admitted to myself that I guess the reason I do this is to try and make the world a better place, if that's, you know, to sound as, you know, lofty as you can. But I mean, this is the only way I know how to do that. And if I can write something that makes someone feel like the music I grew up liking or like currently makes me feel when I listen to it, then I'm doing something good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a fairly pompous and lofty goal. But, you know, I feel like it's a worthy goal. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, I've been lucky so many steps of the way that I can even carry on in pursuit of this goal. You know, it more and more, just like the littlest sound or the littlest chord change or sound that someone makes when they sing can make all the hair on my body stand up or give me a shiver down my spine. And, you know, there is a true magic in this, mm-hmm. you know, in writing words and making music and putting sounds together. So I'm lucky to be able to do that.
You're not imposing it on anyone. I mean, we're doing it because we love it. We're listening to your music because we love it.
20 years ago, though.
And yesterday, listening to the album over and over again, and I got a huge record collection, Josh, and the fact that my wife and I chose to hit play again two or three times meant, you know, that we're getting so much joy, especially out of this new record. Now, at what point do you reveal what you're working on to other people?
That's a good question. I mean, because I think when I'm doing it on my own, like this Plural One project, it's really not until I go record it with this record and the last album, because I was lucky enough to have Jack Irons be a part of it. Mm. Last time I sent him kind of rough early versions of all the songs and kind of said, you know, if you hear anything you hear, let's record. That was when we were in a room together working at a studio. This time he wound up doing drums in his house, two different spots in his house, I think. And it worked out far better than I thought it would. But I only share with him what I thought he would play on. And then it's really just me and Eric Palmquist, the guy who I make records with. I've been working with him for years. And yeah, so I don't really include anyone else. There's a couple I sent, you know, an early mix or a demo to a couple people this time around to see if they wanted to get involved. My friend Steve McDonald played bass he plays second bass a little bit on one of the songs. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have collaborated with people more this record, just because of the way the world is right now. You just can't really do it as easily. And then I had 4 weeks to really get the whole record recorded. So Jack had played on a couple more songs, and then the songs weren't totally, you know, they weren't feeling, but you know, like I hadn't done all my work. Like he played great drums on this one song that I had almost twice as long as it wound up being. And we wound up having to cut it. And then I just wound up having to play the drums. So there's a couple of situations on this record where I didn't intend to do everything and would like to have shared it with other people and gotten them involved. But it wound up being one of those where I sort of had to do most of it myself. But Jack's on the two songs.
When you start with a song, do you have in mind, oh, Steve McDonald would be great on this?
Yeah.
Or is it organic, or how does that work?
Well, that one, I mean, I have the tendency to do this kind of thing. I mean, that it's like beyond organic, because the day I wrote that particular chord progression back in 2014, I remember working on it out in the garage for a couple of hours and just, I couldn't get it out of my head. And then I hung out with Steve that night and we did whatever we did, but I had that song in my head all night. So forever, that song was married to him. And I, in my mind, because we had a, you know, whatever we did that night, I don't know, went out to dinner or whatever experience we had, he was forever a part of that song. So that's why I asked if he'd be willing to play on that one. Mm-hmm. I have different versions of that kind of thing. Yeah, and then obviously just, you know, someone like Jack who's playing, I just always adore. You know, I'm up for him being a part of it, everything and anything.
In your musical history, you always seem to have been the youngest musician in the band. You know, first with Bob Forrest, Bicycle Thief, then of course the Chili Peppers. You've been very fortunate, I guess, to have some great mentors. Are you doing the same with younger musicians now?
No. I'd like to say yes, but I gave Bob Forrest's son a music lesson over Zoom last week. So I don't think of that as mentoring, but maybe I made an impact. I don't know. I don't know that many younger bands or artists, and I definitely have the tendency to be a little bit of an isolationist. So I'm not out there, you know, meeting young bands, but you know, I don't know if I have the confidence to consider myself that for someone else. I generally think of, you know, mm-hmm. of myself still at that age anyway. Like I was saying a little while ago, I mean, I feel like I've been on the same ride since I was 17. So the fact that I'm 41 now, I still feel like I live the same life as I did in my early 20s. So I wouldn't really consider myself in a place to be a mentor.
Now, some of your previous releases with bands like Bicycle Thief or Ataxia, they're only now starting to come out on vinyl, or well, like Ataxia, I guess it came out originally, became super rare, and then got reissued. Is it important for your work to be out on vinyl?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's been one of the greatest things that have happened in the last, you know, 10 years or so, just the return of vinyl and the sort of the primacy that artists and bands give it. I mean, generally, I mean, it's my this last one that's coming out this week, it was kind of a last minute decision on my part to put it out earlier, because we generally like to wait until the vinyl is available. But this time, the vinyl isn't going to be done until, you know, a little while after, and that's a shame. But I also just felt like this record needed to come out. It was done. If I had to sit on it until December, it probably would have driven me a little crazy. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, vinyl is the only thing I really buy mm-hmm. anymore. And yeah, I think it's just the most beautiful format there is.
How many songs do you have in the queue that you're working on right now? Like, do you have enough? Like, when do you see another album coming? Is this like going to be every 6 months, once a year? What do you think the cadence will be on that?
Yeah, well, it depends how the world is, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I'm actually in the studio now. This not today, but I was yesterday. When I made the first one, the To Be One With You album, I did 19 songs, I think, and that was how I was able to put out a couple 7-inches after the fact, or sort of like we did a bundle where you got a, you know, a couple extra songs with the pre-order or something like that. And I wasn't able to do that this time for the fact that I only had a solid 4 weeks. So I'm back in the studio now doing what I'm considering B-sides or extra releases for the I Don't Feel Well period. Because I just love the idea of releasing singles. 7-inches, when I was growing up, there was nothing more exciting than the B-side, you know, the import single. It was a lot of import CD singles at the time. But, you know, my dad had a huge box of 45s when I was growing up. So I was always obsessed with, you know, the single and the lesser known track on the B-side, and kind of the different artwork for the single, and mm-hmm. you know, songs that didn't wind up on albums but were just as popular as singles. Like, those kind of things really excite me. And yeah, so I'm recording those right now, but I have a list, and if time permits, I will start making another album before the year is out. Yeah, I would love to. Well, my dream has always been to be in some sort of project that releases an album a year, no matter what it is. So I'm Plural One is now on that trajectory. I've got one this year and one last year. So if I can get a bulk of next year's out of the way soon, I'd love that. But yeah, I always have a ton of stuff that I'm sort of working on.
Yeah, the B-sides are always sweeter on vinyl. They're never quite as nice when they're an extra track on a CD.
Oh, sir.
So now, one of the rarest records of your career is one that you did with John Frusciante, Shadows Collide With People. Tell me the story of that album. It didn't originally begin as a solo project, as I understand.
No, it was sort of born out of he and my friendship at the time. Just, you know, we spent a lot of time together listening to music a lot, and exploring. I mean, I think that was around the time that he first got his first modular synthesizer. And then I saved up whatever money I was able to cobble together. And then shortly after that, I bought my first modular stuff. Yeah, we were just hanging out all the time, listening to Beatles records and taking the Beatles songbook and sort of looking at the harmonies and kind of singing harmony with each other all night a lot of the time. And then we wrote that song Omission together, just kind of born out of strumming the guitar on the living room floor. And I was bringing my 8-track over to his place and we were doing little demos. He would have a song and then I'd have an idea. We wrote that one together. And before too long, we had a little collection of demos and we were just going to make a record together. But then because of a couple different reasons, mostly, you know, my confidence as a writer at that time and his being in the band and sort of leaving town and touring, like he was writing a lot of songs at that time. And I was not finishing lots of songs at that time. So very soon he had a lot of songs and it just became a larger collection of his songs, which was great. And there was a point right after we started tracking it where it made more sense to kind of consider it a John Frusciante album, which was, and then once it was sort of freed from thinking that he and I had to do everything, we called Chad in to play the drums because I was doing the drums, but it was just he and I tracking. And I had never really, I wasn't playing a ton of drums at that time. And I'd never really done it in a big bright light studio before. So I felt like my takes weren't as confident as they could be. So we called Chad, he came down and this freed me up to play bass. And then we were tracking as a trio. And it's amazing. If you were to listen to the demos we recorded, Chad came in and played exactly like me. I mean, when I listen to that album, I forget that it's him because he's doing my parts perfectly. He listened to it once or twice. I showed him a fill and he knocked it out exactly like I did. And it was phenomenal, the job Chad did on that record. But it was a lot of fun making. But I think at that point, I could think a little harder, but the years, I'm not sure, whenever it was, I mean, John was being really particular about the way things were coming out. So it took a little longer than I think it took a little longer than the subsequent records we made.
Hey, you guys smashed like 6 or 7 out that year or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, shit. But Shadows was a longer production. It took a lot of, you know, like he went back and redid some vocals. Like it took a lot longer after that record came or was done. He sort of felt the opposite in terms of how he wanted to make records. So that's how we made the next couple, Inside of Emptiness and The Will to Death, I think in the opposite order of that. We made those really quickly, like maybe in a week or two, you know, like a week or so of tracking. And then the Ataxia one, same thing. Those were just jams. And then John would write vocals and then he'd come back and then we'd overdub on really quickly. So Shadows was sort of a, you know, I forget exactly how long it took, like a couple months. Mm-hmm. It was more of a production.
It's the high touch collection of songs where the rest of them were just getting them out.
Yeah. And then just being a little less precious. I mean, we were doing, you know, I played drums on the next couple. We were just less, everything about it. Sonically, we were a little more interested in making things that sounded a little more lo-fi, Velvet Underground or garage kind of sound. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, drum wise, I mean, I was listening to a lot of older kind of Kinks or the Seeds or, you know, stuff like that. And I wanted to sound like we were in a garage, you know, instead of with Shadows, we were in what was called Cello at the time, you know, number 2, big, amazing studio, classic room. And it was really, you know, big time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, but that was an amazing experience. I remember because it took so long, like our tastes were changing throughout the recording process. And I don't remember having the idea to do some of those instrumental pieces at the beginning of the record. Those sort of became something we were excited about doing toward the end. Like some of the ones whose names I can't recall exactly, like with the numerical names, mm-hmm. You know, those were born out of listening to, you know, some German music at the time. We were into Michael Rother and, you know, Edgar Froese, I don't know if I'm pronouncing these right, but from Tangerine Dream. He made a solo record or two that we were really into at the time. Those were where those songs came out of. And I'm pretty sure that wasn't on our mind when we started making the record or started planning it out or doing demos of it. So it was cool in a way that it took a while because we were able to sort of turn it into a different animal than it was right at the beginning.
Yeah. And it sounds like you guys were very close collaborators, you know, feeding off each other musically, very close to that period of time. Are you and John still friends at this time, or has that kind of gotten weird now?
I would say it's gotten weird now, but I mean, it got weird 10 years ago when I joined the band. I hadn't really spoken to him in 10 years. We had a little bit of communication right before I left the band because Flea got married. So I saw John at the wedding, but that was the first time I'd seen him and spoken to him in, you know, a decade. Mm-hmm. I saw him once at a movie that we were both at, but I don't think he saw me. The way I look at it is that we'll always be friends and we'll always be connected. And, you know, I've had an amazing opportunity to share some of the experience of being in that band and play some of the amazing music that he wrote with them and make music with those guys. And, you know, whether we're actually in each other's lives on a daily or, you know, on a, you know, current basis is kind of immaterial to me. I'll always love the guy. And, you know, we had a really special relationship and you know, musical relationship for a while. You know, life just does what it does.
Well, look, Josh, I gotta tell you, this Plural One LP, I Don't Feel Well, is a very welcome drink of cool water in the on fire year that is 2020. I've really, really enjoyed listening to this album as well as the first one as well. I got into it a little bit late, but Andrew over at ORG turned me on to the first one, To Be One With You. And this next one is just, I believe, a wonderful cosmic step in your career, which I'm really keen to continue following. I Don't Feel Well is available at orgmusic.com. You could also go to pluralone.merchnow.com. There's a limited edition vinyl pressing. I believe it's gold vinyl, just a couple hundred copies. So grab one of those while you can. And there's also some 7-inches out there of some of the singles and B-sides that Josh spoke about earlier. Again, orgmusic.com or pluralone.merchnow.com. Josh, thanks again so much, not only for the great music, but for coming on the show and being very open and honest and authentic.
Oh, thank you, Nate. Thanks so much for having me. And good luck out there, wherever you are.
Sydney, Australia. We're doing all right.
You're in Sydney, Australia?
I am.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's good. Nice.
I had no idea. Well, if shit goes down, we got a spare room. I don't, you're more than welcome to use. I don't have any 488s you could use, but I'm sure you could pick up something equivalent.
I'll be there in 16 hours. Yeah, yeah. No. Well, thank you, Nate. Yeah, stay safe.
Okay, you too, Josh. Take care.
Bye.
There he is, Mr. Josh Klinghoffer, Plural One, the album I Don't Feel Well, available now on all streaming services. Check it out for yourself. Try before you buy, but if you make that leap to the physical form, then grab a copy quickly at pluralone.merchnow.com. There's a limited edition gold vinyl pressing, just a few hundred copies. Then, of course, there's the black pressing that'll probably be around for years to come. Also, check out Josh's first album, To Be One With You. That's the one that got me hooked. And this new one is the one that's making me stay. So again, all that can be had at pluralone.merchnow.com. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. If you're a record collector and a music nerd, then your friends probably are too. Much appreciated you sharing these links to The Vinyl Guide podcast. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.